We'll move to the second case of the morning, which is Diane Alinsky et al. Versus the United States. Rashback.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Ratzak. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants in this case. As Your Honors are aware, this is the case that involves the mid-air collision over Meigs Field, and one of the primary questions that we raised before this court is the extent of the FAA's continuing responsibility for what happened that day. The primary question here, I believe, is whether or not we all obviously are aware that the FAA delegated to a certain extent what was happening at Midway to Midwest, a private contractor. And the question is, when the FAA did that, did the FAA actually have the authority in 1997 to allow a private contractor to run an FAA Level 1 tower? And the answer to that we find in the section, the specific section of the statute that we've quoted to this court, which authorized the FAA to delegate operation of these towers, or to contract out is the word that the statute uses, operation of these towers with states or political subdivisions of the state, but not
just
private.
A question. You said a level one tower. Is that refer to a low activity airport? Like O'Hare might be.
I think it's level five at O'Hare.
Or something like that.
Exactly. They're a level one.
Just a one airstrip.
Exactly.
That's all.
One runway, a place to park planes. It's the level one program that Congress allowed the FAA to have subcontracted out to the states and their subdivisions. I presume the logic was these are very small towers. In fact, the history is the only way we can keep them open is if we can find some way to save money on these towers, and one way to save money is to avoid the union problems, which led to this whole thing in the first place back, you know, in the Reagan administration when they fired the air traffic controllers when they went on strike. The problem that the FAA has here, I believe, is that when Congress allowed the FAA to have someone else operate these, it said you can have states operate them, but it didn't say anything about having private parties operate them. And that would seem to be a significant omission, and the significance of that omission, I think, is brought to the court's attention and made apparent by the subsequent change in that very statute.
Do you know how many towers there are across the country that are operated by private company controllers?
Someplace in the record, the last number I saw was about 197.
And they're all illegal?
No, but we don't know that. We know that these towers are being operated as level one under the federal contract program, but we don't know if everywhere else the FAA has breached its duties by contracting with private parties. The statute allows them, for example, the FAA could have contracted with the city of Chicago to operate MIGs, but they didn't do that. There's nothing in the record about what these other towers have, how these other towers work. Are they privately operated or not?
So your first challenge then is to whether even Midwest is a viable subcontractor or independent contractor.
The FAA would like us to go that route. Whether they're a viable subcontractor or not, there may be contract arguments to say they can still do what they do. The question is, if the FAA allocated or delegated to someone that they didn't have authority to delegate to, then how can the FAA lose responsibility for what happened that day? How can I, if I cannot legally contract with somebody, then why should I be off the hook, so to speak, for what happened there?
Well, that's a primary question, then.
And that's exactly right. And ironically, to find case law right on point is difficult to do, probably because this doesn't happen that often. We cited, for example, the state court case, a Moorhead case, where the court noted that the fact that a contractor delegated authority to a subcontractor did not mean that the contractor had given up his duty for safe operation of a job site, because the contractor had an owner that he worked with. In this case, we have Congress, who is the owner, if you will. We have the FAA that stands in the role of a general contractor. so to speak, and the FAA said, we'll let Midwest run this, and Congress didn't let them do that.
How is it that Congress and the federal government are subject to state tort law and non-delegable duty law? I mean, that's the thrust of your argument, isn't it? It's not
so much, at this point, a non-delegable duty argument is that they simply do not have the authority to do it. Congress did not let them do what they did. So I don't view it so much as being a non-delegable duty as you would have with an extraordinary, extra hazardous situation.
Well, that gets back to my original question. If that's your argument, then you are saying that all 197 privately operated towers are illegal.
If they're privately operated, I don't know that for a fact, and I don't think that's in the record. If they're all 197 towers are all privately contracted towers, that is exactly right. I cannot do anything about that. It won't be the first time in this world that things have been done on. I would suspect that what happened here is that somebody finally woke up one day and said, my gosh, do you know that they're actually privately contracting out there? We've got to fix the statute so they're not illegal. But that doesn't change the point that as of the date of this accident, the FAA could not do what it did. As a matter of fact, the recent case that the FAA handed into the court this week, the NATCA case in that's the original case in Ohio. The district court came down with a decision finally, and it basically recognized what I'm telling this court today, that when Congress changed that statute, it meant some difference. And if it said in 2003 you can contract with private entities, that means before 2003 you could not. And if you could not, legal or not, nonetheless that meant that the FAA had to retain control. Because if I can't give it to somebody else, I must still have it. And I suggest that is a logical conclusion. It's difficult because I may be telling this court that they made 197 mistakes, but if they did, so be it.
Well, that
I'm sorry.
Can you just clear up? I'm not certain about what the exact theory is here. Is it that the controller on duty was negligent, or
yes,
that the system that allowed only one controller to work in this tower was wrong and was negligently designed or something of that nature? In other words, if there would have been two controllers, this accident wouldn't have happened. What's the claim?
That's really the second point that we have. The first one is that no matter what happened that day, the FAA is responsible for it because it could not legally let somebody else do it. But our second point, and one that I don't think the district court ever really hit head on, is that the operator in the tower was not CIC. She was not qualified to be a controller in charge. Even Tom Tobin, I believe his name, from the FAA, said if this was an FAA tower, the controller on duty that day would have been in violation of Rule 7210, Section 2-4-10.
So then you're not making a claim that the failure to have two controllers on duty was the proximate cause or contributing factor.
We've made that claim. We believe that's a contributing factor. But the paramount claim is that the person in that tower was not qualified. And the reason I'm hedging is because there was evidence at trial, not at the summary judgment, of course, that if there were two operators there that day, only one would be in the tower anyway. So the question gets back to you need to have a qualified operator in the tower. And even the district court judge at page 8 of his first summary judgment order recognized that that operator was not qualified. And that leads to the answer to Your Honor's question. When the FAA set this tower up, they knew that the operators in that tower were not going to be qualified in the first 6 months. It's not a question of discretion or policy or just not knowing. It's a direct, I would almost regard it as a management issue, because when they set this tower up, it had been closed. To be a CIC and to stand watch alone, you have to have the course, 55024, I think, which everybody agrees she did not have. They didn't give it to anybody until there. And you have to be facility rated for 6 months. And you can't be facility rated for 6 months if the facility has just opened up. It need to have 6 months go past before you could be there for 6 months to be facility rated.
Well, you couldn't run it for 6 months then.
If for 6 months what you need to have at that point is you can't be on duty alone. You would need to have two people there, and you would probably need to have somebody in charge who You have to have two people on duty, I think, is probably what it requires.
Well, then you get back to, then you are arguing that the failure to have two people in the
exactly.
tower.
Exactly. It gets back to that point. It does get back to the point. The bottom line is that everybody agrees at this point, remembering that we were at the summary judgment stage when this was knocked out, not at the trial. There was some evidence at trial that the six-month rule had been waived. But we answered that, I think, in our reply brief, that there was an internal memo discussing it, saying the six-month rule had been waived. But the memo, and I think it's a memo of July the 3rd, I believe it's document 53. I think I called it Exhibit 53 and meant docket 53, Exhibit 6. It's an internal memo that says, we will ask for a change in the rule, a change in the order, to allow a private tower, because it wasn't clear that a private tower could ever get a waiver, to allow a private tower to obtain a waiver. But the rule was never changed. I assumed when that change was made that somebody would have changed it, but we've checked the FAA order, and it's never been changed. So even though obviously the FAA intended to ask the DOT for permission to change the rule, it never did that. And if it did not change the rule, this person was not qualified to be there. Remembering that this person had not been in a control tower for 6 years. She basically just stepped in and was running federal airspace where the federal law, federal authority is supreme. Every case has said sovereign airspace. That's the phrase used. It's something that the FAA controls. The FAA knew this had to be the case because when the contract came in to them from Midwest, the bid, you can figure out we have this many controllers, they'll work this many hours, and we've got this much time to cover. You cannot have two people on duty all the time. It won't work. So the FAA knew when this tower started operation that there were going to be unqualified people up there. That's what makes this case very different.
I have one question that's just mostly curiosity, but there was a third plane involved, apparently. And I don't understand how or what that was about. And I don't want to get sidetracked, mm-hmm. except this seems to be sort of a unique area. This is Chicago, and it's a very heavy air traffic.
Exactly.
And then you have this little island here right in the middle of all that air traffic with one person controlling, and I don't know who they – do they have – does the radar pick up everybody that's flying around, or just people that fly below a certain level?
No, if it's under 4,000 feet, I believe. Level one towers deal with, I think, aircraft under 4,000 feet. I don't believe, does this facility have radar at the time? Those are the trial lawyers. I did not think so. One of the allegations of the amended complaint was that they should have had radar in. This is a visual flight facility. You call in as the pilot. The operator picks you up and then tells you to land. The problem in this case is that, as Your Honor said, someplace in the record there's talk about a third aircraft, but it wasn't involved in the crash.
But wasn't there a determination that it was the third plane that caused the crash?
At this point, all I'm working with on this issue is summary judgment. So we never, because the trial court cut us off, we never got to the causation issues. As far as I know, no. These were two planes that were misdirected, and they literally hit head-on. My question...
I just thought I had noticed somewhere in the record that there was a finding of some, maybe an investigation after the fact, that the third plane caused the other two to run into each other.
Not at all. These people just didn't know, each did not know the other was there. One was being told to land, the other one was just ignored, and they ended up hitting head on. A family member asked me last night, how can two planes hit head on? Apparently, I've been told if two planes approach each other in the sky, the last thing you can see is somebody coming straight at you. It doesn't stand out. That's why, part of what Your Honor said, this is not an easy airport. It's a small airport, but it's in the middle of, you saw the Elgin, Midway, and O'Hare, and you have a situation where experience might have mattered. Even if this controller had had the course doesn't tell you how to operate a control tower, but it does tell you how to operate a facility, and she's been there alone for 6 hours. If she had had the course, which everybody agrees wasn't waived, could not be waived, and she did not have it, maybe it would have given her the confidence, the background, to feel comfortable with her job so that she would have not been like a first-year lawyer appearing before this court, hardly able to speak to you, but relaxed and able to focus and see these two planes and do the right thing. But that, I'm getting down the road because, and part of it is because this was a summary judgment, keeping in mind that the court, the district court, knocked everything out that we had, other than our third point, which was the question of whether or not the federal government basically abused its discretion in terms of allowing the or approving the Midwest's request for a new controller. As to that point, the argument is essentially that there is in fact a discretionary of policy making protection under the Federal Tort Claims Act. We don't argue with that. The problem is that in this situation, there isn't any real evidence that the FAA actually exercised any discretion. In its first opinion, the district court judge noted in his first discretion that there wasn't a hint of what procedures were used. When they finished the trial, I would suggest to this court there still isn't a hint as to actually what happened in this case with this request. They talked about our general policies, our general process for handling requests, but there is no specific evidence here that we took this request by Midwest for a controller and we examined it, and this is why it took almost 3 months?
I thought there was evidence that this request came in as a non-emergency request, and it was slotted into the non-emergency procedure and dealt with in the ordinary course. And isn't that a discretionary judgment call?
It is. I cannot say that slotting it as a non-emergency, but it still does not say making it a non-emergency calling it a non-emergency doesn't mean that you don't have to give it some prompt attention. If in fact they've been told that there is a problem here and it's a serious problem, any problem with air traffic must be serious, why didn't they explain to us in this case it took 3 months? The request went in April, and I don't believe that the confirmation did not come back until July. Just to say, it was non-emergency, so we did look at it. If the court believes that's sufficient, that cures that point. I can only be straightforward with the court and say that's it. But we suggest that that's not what the Federal Tort Claims Act was talking about when they talked about discretion. I would think that you would need to show some reason why in this case it took that long. It wouldn't take much. But all we got were general discussions of why it would take that long.
That substitutes the liability inquiry for the immunity inquiry. Let's assume that it took too long. But
correct.
The initial decision to put it into that category was a discretionary decision that's entitled to immunity.
But once it's in that category, it's still a discretionary decision as to how long it takes. The evidence wasn't that you put it on a runway and it stays there. The evidence was if it is classified as non-emergency, it's still a discretionary call as to how long it takes. It doesn't mean it has to take 3 months.
Well, is there any evidence that this took longer than the standard non-emergency?
No, the evidence was that it usually takes 6 to 8 weeks. This request went in April, and I don't believe it was approved until July the 3rd, if I have my dates right. That's a long time, with no explanation. And we're not talking about even the stops. We're talking about air traffic control, which underlies most of our argument, that this is a different situation. I'm well into my rebuttal time. Unless the court has further questions right now, I'd like to save that time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Riegel?
May it please the court, Stephen Riegel, Department of Justice, and with me is Jill Dahlman Rosa and Mr. Mark Balin of the Federal Aviation Administration. We are, over the last 7 years, have tried this case through the pleadings, the motions, the trial, and now this appeal. I have several questions the court asked of Mr. Rathsack, which I could give more specific answers to, but essentially, we are here on a very simple matter. The court's inquiry, like the district court below, is that of jurisdiction. The jurisdiction of the district court is solely that provided by the United States under the Federal Tort Claims Act, by the express text of that statute, and by crystal clear on-point U.S. Supreme Court decisions, and I'm referring primarily to Logue and Orleans. The law is clear that the United States is not liable for the torts of its independent contractors. On the day of this tragic mid-air collision, there were no federal employees in or near the Meigs Field Air Traffic Control Tower. The only people there were employees of the contractor, Midwest Air Traffic Control Incorporated. It had the FAA contract to operate all of the towers in the Great Lakes region. That's a series of states centered on Illinois, which include seven other states. And Midwest bid for and got the entire region.
How many would that be?
At that time, it was about 151. The number has grown to approximately 200 at the present time. I'm referring to overall contract towers. Midwest had roughly...
You're talking about the United States.
I'm talking about the entire United States. Midwest had perhaps 30 of those. This is a busy region, but they had a single contract which applied to all of the level one towers in this region. And to go back to another question Your Honor had asked, level one refers simply to the traffic count, how many operations. An airport could be a big multi-runway airport left over from World War II and still have very few airplanes coming and going. In those days, the FAA used a five-level system with O'Hare and its like being number five and the sleepiest airports like Meigs Field being level one. What that means, practically speaking, is these can be very sleepy airports. Sometimes a half hour would go by with not a single operation, and other times things could get busy. But they were back when the FAA operated Meigs and during the entire contract period and to the present day, although Meigs Field is now closed, but referring to non-busy airports, typically staffed with one controller on duty. I'm giving this by way of background, not discussing issues of federal liability, because the staffing is the responsibility of Midwest, as is the operation.
But there's no radar, apparently.
Correct.
And with no radar, other than, what do they just keep in touch on radio and then make sure there's nobody in the way on the runway? What is the duty of a controller at this stage if you have no radar?
I do, sir. The air traffic control for a small VFR airport, going back to when Meigs Field was operating, there is an area of airspace which is under the control of the tower, and it typically goes up to about 3,000 feet above the field and goes out about 5 miles. It's a little more complicated because of Chicago, but that's the tower's airspace. Pilots are, under the Federal Aviation Regulations, must make radio contact with the tower before they enter that airspace, and then the tower will clear them to land or tell them to follow another airplane or something of that sort. So what we're talking about here, the facts of this case involved the tragic deaths of seven people, but they all chose to fly that day. Three of them were in one airplane coming up from the south. Four of the people were in a single-engine Cessna, and it had made a sightseeing flight. Came up the Chicago lakefront, flew over Meigs Field with the permission of the tower, got the permission of the tower to fly up to Navy Pier and make a U-turn and come back. And came back, the pilot of that airplane failed to make a mandatory report. The controller had said, that's approved, report when you're passing the field on the way south. The pilot failed to do that and collided head-on with the other airplane that was inbound to land. Well, perhaps a little more aviation than I should have gone into, but without radar, the controllers deal with pilots as they call on the radio. I mentioned a radio call that was not made by a pilot here, and what they can see and observe out the window.
It doesn't have anything to do with the preemption issues here, but what happened to this third plane? What was that about?
Let me answer it in this manner, Your Honor. The normal participants in a case like this would be the two pilots and the control tower operator, in this case Midwest. They were all sued in state court, along with others, like the Chicago Gary Airport Authority. All of those cases led to settlements, multi-million dollar settlements, in the state court just before trial. One claim remained, and that was a somewhat oddball claim, that a pilot of a third airplane who had been in the vicinity, who had attempted to put his landing gear down and had a light on the panel say, your gear may not be safe. We're not sure if you can confirm the gear is down and locked. He called the tower controller, reported his problem, asked to make a flyby so that the tower could look with binoculars and see if the gear was down. He then asked if he could orbit in the vicinity of the field and check out the procedures. He talked a lot on the radio. This was a pilot dealing with a genuine emergency. If you're in a small airplane and you can't get the gear down, you have the possibility of at least an expensive and maybe a catastrophic landing. It's important to get the wheels down. The argument was that this pilot, faced with an emergency, unreasonably talked and talked on the radio and chose to orbit right in the vicinity and distracted the controller, and that was the argument. Frankly, somewhat far-fetched to people in the aviation community, but the proof of the pudding is that it went to a state court jury just up the street here, judgment for plaintiff for over $2 million against the pilot and the insurance policy, obviously, of that third airplane, who supposedly, by being too verbose in his emergency, contributed to the action. I'm happy to discuss these aspects of it. I'm hesitant to get into the air traffic control side because, again, we're here saying having the only inquiry before this court is to affirm the rulings of Judge Zagel. The record is clear that upon the initial filing of the United States motion to dismiss almost 6 years ago, he gave extensive discovery to the plaintiffs. They got a chance to explore every possibility of direct federal negligence. And if you look back in the record on the original 21 causes of action, very able counsel, many in this courtroom today, pushed as hard as they could. There simply was nothing there. Judge Zagel dismissed 19 causes of action on motion, two of them that were a little complicated factually, although also off on the side, went to a trial in this building, and we prevailed on all of them. Judge Zagel's factual findings we submit are firmly supported in the record. His legal findings, which this court reviews de novo, are also well-reasoned.
What about this as far as the challenge to Midwest being an appropriate independent contractor? I'm not sure how far that can go to where everybody in the country is not proper, but what is the standards?
To answer Judge Sykes' question to the other counsel, indeed, plaintiff's challenge, if successful, would invalidate the program somehow for all of these. First answer is jurisdictionally that is not before the court. To the extent you're challenging an administrator's action in this court action, it's a discretionary function. Secondly, the FAA administrator, as the senior most official in the Federal Aviation Administration, has extraordinarily broad statutory authority. We cited in our brief three sections of 49 United States Code, Section 10616, Section 40110, Section 40111, which is about as broad as it gets. Authority to enter into contracts, may acquire services, has authority to enter into contract for services. The FAA administrator has taken the position, and it is amply borne out by the Federal Aviation Administration Act and its successors, that she has very broad authority to contract. Even if she didn't, and I'm getting into Alice in Wonderland here, I cannot imagine how a court would accept the idea that the administrator cannot make a program like this. Even were that the case, the only negligence alleged here is that of one controller in the tower, Ms. Renee Toon, an employee of Midwest. Were there a challenge to authority, and I refer to the NATCA case that we supplemented in Ohio, that can lead sometimes to revisions and to directions back and forth, and I'm talking over in an APA challenge to the agency. Here, nothing can convert Ms. Toon into an FAA employee. Nothing brings the negligence of Ms. Toon. I'm talking personalizing it, the one controller who they say made a mistake. Nothing can convert her into an employee of a federal agency. Without that threshold showing, there is no jurisdiction of the court. The court's inquiry simply need go no further. Plaintiff made two arguments in the appeal brief, one with reference to the section of the act amended in 1994 after this contracting process was underway, and as we pointed out, that is a specific section about the contract tower program, but it's not the one the FAA is relying on. The administrator has so stated publicly the administrator's broad authority to contract. That applies to contracts with state and local governments. The NATCA district court case, and I mean the National Association of Air Traffic Controllers in Ohio, has so held with that issue before them. Also, the plaintiff's attempt, I heard Mr. Rathsack attempt to say he's not so much asserting a non-delegable duty argument. Well, with respect to my adversaries, they either are or they aren't. This challenge to authority is clearly saying FAA didn't have authority to contract, therefore hold them responsible for this airspace, for this controller's actions. Number one, you can't do that under the Federal Tort Claims Act, but number two, the law is also crystal clear Supreme Court authority that non-delegable duty argument is a state court exception. The Moorhead case, which Mr. Rathsack cited in his reply brief and referred to this morning, is a state court case of a general contractor and a sub. Were we across the street defending an Illinois general contractor, I would not be making these arguments, because our arguments fundamentally are jurisdictional, they are threshold, and they deprive this court and the district court of jurisdiction to make such an award. I wanted to address one point that was raised only in my adversary's reply brief, because this is my only chance to do so. It's the six-month waiver issue resolved in our favor in the trial court below, I think clearly a sound ruling. But in his reply brief, Mr. Rathsack went off into some exhibits and seemed, well, he was not the trial counsel. I think he went to the wrong sections. I want to invite the court's attention, if you get to the merits of that, to two exhibits. Trial Exhibit 406, which is the actual waiver, dated July 2, 1997, and in the Appellee's Supplemental Appendix, page SA69, that was an email sent out to the contract towers in the spring of 97 saying, essentially, don't worry about the six-month waiver. We know you're starting up new towers. Nobody has 6 months' experience. Therefore, nobody can stand watch alone. By the way, it is worse than you suggested, Judge Evans, in your question, because two controllers wouldn't cure it. Neither of them has 6 months. They're all newcomers. It's an impossibility. You cannot start a tower with saying the only person in charge has to have 6 months' experience at that field when the field is Meg's field and it's been closed. It's just one of those circular arguments. Again, I'm going further into the facts than perhaps I should, uninvited, because having adequately trained and having adequately screened and qualified controllers was the responsibility of Midwest. The FAA's oversight of that, which was capable and thorough and the subject of trial testimony, is nonetheless protected by discretionary function. In conclusion, Your Honors, we feel that this is, despite the length of the briefs before the court, a simple, straightforward jurisdictional issue. The record is clear that the plaintiffs had ample chance to explore any direct FAA negligence, and the cases under the FTCA contract exception, which go against the United States, a great many of them are cases in which there are federal actors on the scene working side by side or with contractors, and there's a factual question. Again, here it was all Midwest Air Traffic Control. It was their tort. The state court process has worked as expected, and the United States is immune from suit to the extent direct federal negligence was alleged. The record amply supports Judge Zagel's findings under the clearly erroneous standard that there was no federal negligence that contributed in any way. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Rathsack.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to just begin with one quick point. If, in fact, the FAA really believed that it was authorized to delegate not only the operation but the responsibility for the operation of these towers, then why does the FAA insist on every contract that the private contractor indemnify the FAA for anything that occurs? The only reason that you would put that in there is if, in fact, you could be sued and you would be liable, because that's what the indemnity provision is for. It screams out that even the FAA at some level understood, even though they had these people operate these towers, it's still our baby, so to speak.
The lawyers always do that, though, don't they?
They do.
In the unlikely event that we would ever be found liable, we're entitled to indemnification from somebody else.
If that's why they put it in here, I guess I would expect someone to have brought that up along the way when these contracts came out. But, you know, it suggests to me that, and we're dealing at a summary judgment stage, that, in fact, you know, that's why it was there. There's no reason to put it there otherwise. Literally, we have to look at it literally, I believe. Your Honor asked, Judge Sykes asked about the program itself, if they're illegal. The validity of the entire Level 1 program, whether it's delegated to private or to state authorities, is still under attack in Ohio in the NATCA case. That has still not been resolved. We're not fishing with this court. We're not asking this court for some kind of a pie in the sky finding. It is, in fact, something that's been at issue in the Sixth Circuit for all these years and still hasn't been concluded, even with the last decision.
But you do concede that your entire argument here on the federal government's liability calls into question the legality of private contracting of airports as a general matter.
I don't believe that this court has to. This court could write that opinion. I think this court could just say that Congress at a minimum allowed the government to delegate the operation, but not delegate responsibility. Even in the 1998 report, which I think is Exhibit 15 or 16 to the government's summary judgment motion, a congressional report, they talked about the FAA managing these Level 1 airports under the FTC, the Federal Tower Contract Program. The Congress expected the FAA to stay there and to be looking at these towers, which would sort of suggest why the FAA, in fact, thought, well, we can have people operate them, but we're supposed to still make sure it's run safely. We still have that responsibility. We did not delegate that. My time is up, unless there are more questions from the
court.
That's
fine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This case will be taken under advisement.